Welcome to the DevCon Archives, featuring top sessions from the latest DevCon, which took place in Bangkok in November 2024. These episodes spotlight some of the best talks from the largest Ethereum developer conference, showcasing the technical advancements, mission, projects, and novel ideas shaping the Ethereum ecosystem. All talks have been recorded. You can find them on archive.devcon.org. Let's dive into today's featured talk.
So today's panel topic is Western liberalism toward liberalism. In order to set up the common ground for this panelist, because we have a very myriad setup of panelists, I would love to have each of you to have a quick, very succinct sentence to tell us what do you think about liberalism and what does that mean to you. So I guess I'll start from Ahmed.
To me, liberalism is a set of values, and it's to be distinguished from Western liberalism because I don't think there was anything ever inherently Western about it. They're values which tend to resonate with all of humanity across the world from different cultures and times.
I think it's a bundle of concepts that includes things like democracy, individual rights, freedom, pluralism, property rights, concern about centralization of power, and a lot of things that I think resonate with all kinds of people in all kinds of contexts historically and definitely with this community.
For me, liberalism is the pursuit of freedom and individual dignity, and I think that technology here plays a huge role enabling self-sovereign governance and basically on a global scale.
Yes, the pursuit of freedom, but by definition the pursuit of freedom cannot be done only from one place, cannot be imposed from one place. That's why I like the term world liberalism, you know, just like world music or world food. It has to include every tradition, every culture. Otherwise, it's not freedom. Otherwise, it's imposition from one side to the other.
All right. I appreciate those answers. I think no matter how cynical you are, I think hearing those answers, you really think to yourself, like, these are good things. These are good things for human, right? And for all of our panelists, as well as myself, the moderator, maybe except from Bruno, we're all sort of born in a society where liberalism is not the default. And I was previously talking about how my story living in China, growing up in China, had this experience of secondhand liberalism, where I learned about liberalism from the internet, from the movies, from the TV shows. And there's no liberalism practice in the society, but liberalism was also very tangible in the online space. I want to direct the first question to Bruno, actually. This panel actually stemmed from your idea of, you know, coining this word, world liberalism. So can you maybe give us an overview of how this idea come to you and why you want to add world liberalism on top of liberalism? Like, what's the difference between world liberalism versus this old plain liberalism we understand?
Yes, so I think many people are suspicious of the term liberalism, and I would argue they're suspicious because we sometimes tend to assume liberalism as being just Western, and you know, Western liberalism has its limitations. So we need to expand the concept, and I give you three ways in which it needs to be expanded. Well, first of all, if we're concerned about freedom, we have to be concerned about the freedom of everyone. But unless you make an effort to see things from the perspective of other people, other cultures, you tend to overvalue your own freedom and devalue the freedom of others. You know, we can't just be concerned about the freedom of Ukrainians to build their own country. We have to be concerned about the freedom of Palestinians to build their own country. But I've noticed if you come from a certain culture, you see only the freedom of Ukrainians. And if you come from a certain culture, you see only Palestinian freedom. I think a global perspective that includes every single perspective, we can be concerned about freedom everywhere. Very quickly, second way, you know, we know that liberalism is supposed to be about overcoming state propaganda and state control. But how can you overcome state propaganda and state control unless you make an effort to see your own state from another perspective? Well, let's try to see America from the perspective of China and China from the perspective of America and do this iteration all the time. And finally, the third, there's no other way to get rid of state propaganda. And third, even certain kinds of freedoms are not available in our society simply because there are different trade-offs. There are certain experiences of nature that you can have perhaps in a society like Japan, but not in a society like the United States. Certain experiences of family, of religion, that you can have in Muslim societies and you can't have in the West. So if we want a really comprehensive sense of freedom, we have at least to understand that there are different experiences of freedoms in different places. So my attempt would be to try to have a much broader understanding of liberalism that is just not just the way to look at the world from one place.
Right. The next question is about Ethereum. Ethereum itself is an aggregation of a lot of things about its people. It's you guys, it's us. It's about thousands of thousands of people in this venue. It's about technology. It's also about resource. So the question to Vitalik is, how would you describe the liberal aspect of Ethereum? And how does its core mechanism reflect or deviate from liberalism?
I think there's two levels at which you can look at it. So one level is the perspective of just what Ethereum is technically and what it enables, in the sense that it is a decentralized platform that allows people to build applications, and to use Bruno's language, that basically means it's a platform that tries to avoid having a single master administrator, but at the same time empowers anyone in the network to create their own piece and to administrate their own piece, and even give them the ability to take away their own ability to administer pieces of that, if that's what they want to do to give people confidence. But like those technical aspects, I think, are important. But I think there's another more interesting level, which is Ethereum as a community and as an organism as a whole, right? Because this is a blockchain ecosystem. It always has to solve this fundamental problem of a 51% attack, right? If you have something that aims to be decentralized and to give people on top of it confidence and stability through that, then there's always the risk that at multiple levels, consensus, research, development, other levels too, that like some actor gains too much power and then tries to twist the entire platform toward their own objectives. And Ethereum, I think, has this really interesting culture of really explicitly trying to create something that is very resilient against that, right? So there's a very explicit effort to try to build a global community. There's this very explicit effort to try to create multiple Ethereum client teams, so there isn't like one client team that has all of the practical power to write the rules of the protocol. There's an explicit effort to try to involve different, all kinds of different new people in research, development, different levels of discussion, and the Ethereum Foundation itself, right, we have this philosophy of subtraction, which is basically that the goal of the foundation is not to grow the foundation. The goal of the foundation is to grow other things that can then enable the success of the ecosystem. And like the analogy that I would make, right, is that one of the things that often gets blamed for the failure of democracy in Russia in the 1990s to last is basically that there was pretty much no civil society, right? You had the Soviet Union. Soviet Union suddenly disappeared. and there was like nothing there to take over a lot of functions, and it basically pretty much immediately entered the oligarch era, right? And if you want Ethereum to be something that actually can be resilient and robust, and like that civil society layer that is both not a centralized thing and is also not just profit maximizing actors, like that needs to be strong, right? And the foundation's goal is to try to intentionally build up that layer so it can be strong. And so I think it's also this really fascinating experiment and like trying to see, can we actually create a virtual organism that's built on these principles and that can actually work based off of them?
Yeah, I think in the world where, you know, you take growth as this inevitable social justice, I think Ethereum Foundation's philosophy of subtraction is, in a sense, like trying to create more, you know, borrowing Bruno's word, creating more master game designers in the meta system. So in case you didn't come to this space earlier, Amit gave us a really amazing talk about system failure in the Middle East. A part of the system of failure and, you know, whatever terrible things that were going on there was due to, in a sense, Western intervention. And for societies like China, Middle East, the society often associate liberalism with this infiltration, with hypocrisy. And in this panel, when we're talking about from world liberalism to, from Western liberalism to world liberalism, do you think people in the Middle East can accept this concept? And do you think it's possible today to infuse new meanings into the term, or it's easier for us just to coin a newer term?
I do think that the term is has become toxic. It's dirty by association with all the things that have been done in its name. And the concept of Western liberalism, like being coined as a term, two words together, was a huge blunder, because what Western democracies did was take this set of values that is pretty universal, that, you know, sounds attractive to pretty much all people in all societies, and try to monopolize that within specific societies, and to persuade the world that this came together with a larger package, which it didn't have to. So it was basically, it became associated with a certain power structure, which is like a post-colonial power structure. It has the holdovers of a colonial system in which parts of the world dominated the rest. And that's still what people associate it with today. Nowadays, people associate it with you know, the genocide happening in Gaza, the idea that Western nations will claim to uphold certain values, but only apply them to, for example, specific victims. It's a tragedy when Ukrainians are being forced out of their homes or are being occupied or are being ethnically cleansed, but that's a tragedy because they're perceived to be Western people, and therefore Western liberalism applies to them. And with non-Western people, these values do not apply. So when I speak to my fellow Muslims about liberal ideas, I tend to avoid the word, but I also talk about it in a different way. I don't, you know, start with John Locke and John Stuart Mill. That's not relevant to us. I take the stories which resonate inside our own culture. So I'd probably, you know, start the conversation with the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and I talk about how he lived in a cosmopolitan society and created institutions which allowed the Jewish minority within that society, for example, to have their own legal system, which they could feel satisfied abiding with. The way he organized intercommunal relations to enable people to kind of proceed from a level playing field, the way that they were treated equally economically, and that resonates far more than you know, starting the story with, well, these ideas were invented by the ancient Greeks and then passed to Western civilization, and now we have to take them from them because it turns out they have something so much better than you know, what we always had.
Yeah, thank you for the answer. So just following, you know, we talked, Amit, and I know Diego, previously we talked about this, like you agree with Amit's points where, you know, those Western institutions need some radical transformations. Why do you think that way? And also, I know your background, so can you please paint us a picture of Argentina's complex relationship and complex interplay between state crisis, crypto's proposition, and liberalism itself?
Yeah, I agree with Ahmed that Western governing institutions will change, and mostly as they had changed in the past because of technology. When writing appeared, feudalism and the church control information and govern humanity, then that was replaced by nation states, basically because of the appearance of a new technology of the printing press. And I think that current institutions are not suited for the digital world that we live in. We have so much better ways of potentially governing ourselves than the institutions that today rule us. And I think that in, I don't know, years from now, I hope to see it, institutions will start to evolve in a new manner. And I think that the way that Ethereum is governed, we were chatting that before, is perhaps a test, a way of showing how to govern large-scale projects in a different way as we govern our society today. And Argentina is this strange case in which we are an extremely rich country from an objective perspective regarding natural resources. We have a huge talent pool in Argentina, but we have been failing as a nation since, I don't know, the last 70 years. We haven't been able of providing prosperity to the inhabitants of Argentina, and that is because of failing institutions. And that created this particular model in which we Argentinians were always forced to survive in extreme economic conditions, in extreme instability from political and institutional powers. Just to give an idea, the other day this guy published a website in which you entered your date of birth and it calculated how much inflation you suffered in a lifetime. I entered my date of birth and I suffered a 30 trillion percent inflation. That is, I mean, we Argentinians are economic Navy SEALs. We need to survive. We're under attack constantly. So when crypto appeared, Bitcoin, Ethereum appeared, it was not something to speculate, oh, this, let me try. It was a need for survival. We need to get out of this falling economy in whichever way we can. Let's explore this. And on the second hand, we are used for institutions to fail. We know that institutions are not trusty. Hence, we embrace this idea of trying to govern ourselves and gaining personal agency in different matters. And I want to be pretty clear, although the Argentinian past has been so awful, I'm extremely optimistic regarding its future, extremely optimistic. And precisely because of this, precisely because of we have been under such harsh conditions, that we developed kind of a landscape in which innovations in how we govern ourselves, in institutions, in economic means, in adopting decentralization, have a very, very good ground to evolve and to grow.
I appreciate the answer. Next question is for Vitalik. I guess this question can be divided into two parts. Following your first answer, if world liberalism, we'll stick with world liberalism for now. If world liberalism represents certain values and speak to the ethos of Ethereum, how can we make it more legible and how can we make it more visible? And the second part is, so for a lot of Western liberal countries, they often have this independent or third-party institute like Gallup or Human Rights Watch. Those institutes, they would use, you know, although sometimes problematic and over-abstract metrics to measure their liberalness. It goes to Ethereum. Do you think it's possible for us to establish some Ethereum Human Rights Watch or Ethereum Gallup to study and to quantify how Ethereum's projects contribute to world socially, economically, and ideologically? In your blog post about how to make Ethereum value alignment more legible, you also talked about you want to see more projects like L2 Beats to appear. Can you maybe like imagine another L2 Beats, but focus beyond just technical and decentralization aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the challenges that Ethereum has, right, is that there are these values that everyone likes to talk about, and there's this challenge, and like there's often this gap between what gets talked about and what actually is real for people, right? And everyone talks about being a roll-up, but then some of those roll-ups, like actually, basically, the provider holds your coins, and they can do whatever they want with those coins at any time. And other roll-ups actually are not that way. And if they shut down, like you actually do have an on-chain mechanism that you can use to take your coins back out, right? And like that second aspect, like those values actually being reality is really important, right? It's, like liberalism in politics, it's the sort of thing that is very easy to just completely forget about in a normal situation when things are in equilibrium, but there's always some key moment that arises when it suddenly becomes clear that it's everything. And L2Beat, I think, is definitely one of those good examples that basically tells you, is a roll-up actually a roll-up, or is it one of these systems where the operator can just take coins out whenever they want, and it's basically just a glorified centralized exchange? I think, but it's only measuring a few things, right? I think other things that could be measured are open source is one, right? If something is open source, then other people can build upon it. Also, other people can inspect it. And it also limits the provider's own ability to abuse their power if they get too powerful. Open standards is another one, right? There's value in building on open standards, and there is sometimes a phenomenon where people claim to be building on open standards, but actually they are the ones that are pushing a standard in a way where they're the only ones that are really on that standard, and this becomes a way to create a walled garden and dominate an ecosystem. Decentralization, and also contribution to both the Ethereum ecosystem and to the outside world, which is starting to happen more and more, and the whole regen side of the Ethereum ecosystem is really fascinating there. I mean, I think for all of those things, there's definitely value in creating more metrics and in tracking more metrics. I think my philosophy on metrics is that, like, zero metrics is not the answer, because if you have zero metrics, then it is too easy for anyone to just virtue signal and basically, say that the thing they were going to do anyway actually is the way to instantiate the value. One metric is not the answer, because this is like, it becomes like a social credit score. It becomes this, like, standardized thing that just accumulates a huge amount of power. To me, the only answer is pluralism. The answer is to have many metrics that are all kind of competing with each other on an uncertain playing field for legitimacy.
If I could just add to that question, there's a term I heard a couple of days ago. I'm not sure if I'm using it right, but the term was credible neutrality. One of the things that's gone wrong with Western liberalism is basically abandoning even the pretense to some kind of neutrality in the rules of the system and how they're applied. Mm. Is there some way of measuring the number of different perspectives from which the rules being written in this system are coming from?
That is a fascinating question. I think one of the challenges is that perspectives is so hard to define, right? Because you can look into, you can do GitHub archaeology and all core devs archaeology and even try to figure out who was responsible for a particular EIP getting included. Although actually, possibly, much less of that information is being legible than it could be. The next question then is like, what you can then look and see, well, what are there perspectives that actually have been included? And often it's easier to identify specific failures than it is to identify success, right? So for example, one type of specific failure that has been identified sometimes is when the perspectives of researchers who care about decentralization and who also care about cleanness and mathematical purity and certain like software engineering aesthetics get taken into account, but the perspectives of users do not get taken into account. And that's something where there's increasingly like different community groups trying to figure out how to correct for. So I think it's like, to me, like perfect neutrality for some like complicated decision making is not achievable, right? It's the analogy I use is it's like, imagine like you have a chess position, and you know, imagine you're in the middle of like some game between like Magnus Carlsen and Garry Kasparov, right? And like you ask, what is the credibly neutral chess move? And like there is no answer. But the thing that you can identify is you can identify when you have specific biases, right? You can say, well, this player clearly overvalues material and undervalues position, right? And that's a thing you can say, and that's a thing you can correct for, but then it's an endless project to try to like keep identifying those biases and keep improving.
Thank you. The next question, I guess, primarily I want to ask for Bruno, but I would love all the panelists to answer it. Bruno, in your latest book, you argue that American liberalism isn't failing, but rather undergoing this metamorphosis. And you also sort of position that America is developing what you call political virtualism. This is so given America still wielding its immense power, and just take a case of any gadget in your hand, the code, the rules of writing the code, and the rules of designing such machine is perhaps originated from the United States. My question here is, how can we foster a less America-centric environment for one, political discussion, and next, for Ethereum-based technological innovation? And I would love to have all the panelists to more or less answer this question.
So starting with Ethereum, you know, I believe quite firmly that the ethos of Ethereum can be applied outside Ethereum. So it would be perfectly conceivable, I think, that someone who spent the teenage years developing within the Ethereum framework would go on and work at the UN, say, and take those principles. I don't think Vitalik 10 years ago was thinking about how to solve the problem of the UN. So I don't think we should assume that Ethereum as it exists now will solve the very serious problem that we don't have a global framework for stability and cooperation. But what would be quite possible, and I think desirable, would be for people to take those principles that Vitalik talked a little bit about to other areas, that ethos, that culture, in fact, that discipline, because I think it's a lot about discipline. You got the idea by now that I'm very interested in this notion of virtual reality and that we live in virtual reality. And I argue in the previous book that America had moved to virtual reality. And when it comes to virtual reality, I think there's a decisive ethos that we have to embrace. Do we create virtual worlds for our private enjoyment to sort of pursue our most hidden desires without limits? Or do create virtual worlds of great complexity that can encompass the highest possible number of possibilities and experiences? So if you think about Westworld, the series and the movie, there's something very perverse about how many of those people regard virtual worlds. You enter the virtual world only to express your desires. What I see in Ethereum is, in fact, from the beginning when I got interested in it, is that it's the other way around. That the community sees itself as made up of builders. That the richer the virtual world being created is, the better. This is not a virtual world being created only for the sake of experimenting with one particular thing. And I think in the community there's this permanent criticism of, is this open enough? Is this general enough? Is this capacious enough? And so on, both at the level of the system as a whole, but of different applications that are developed. So I like the idea Vitalik just expressed now at the end, that one has to correct for biases and always be attentive to biases. Now imagine if these ethos were taken to other areas of our life where it's so sorely needed, that I think would be very important.
I would add to what Bruno said that, in answering to you, Arfran, that I think that what we see today in, for example, the Ethereum ecosystem is that there's no such thing as, in my perspective, as America dominance. It's build the dominance. If you build a great idea, a great product, a great feature, whatever, nobody cares where you come from. Nobody cares who you are. I mean, they care about what you build. And I completely agree with what Bruno said regarding that in the upcoming years, most probably the ethos of Ethereum will get exported to other realities. And that will start tapping that change in governance which I planted before. Young people that have been living in this ethos, in this community for the last 10 years, will most probably pursue to change realities in which we govern ourselves and makes basically no sense in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for Ethereum, there's always different things that we can do, right? And I mean, to give like some concrete examples, one thing that the foundation tries to do more and more is to explicitly involve support builders in different kinds of different parts of the world, and even try to get them involved in areas that are closer to Ethereum core development, right? And like one of the interesting statistics is that 80% of the of PSE, right, the Ethereum Foundation ZK team, is from East and Southeast Asia, and this actually happened even without my involvement, right? This happened, and at some point I just learned about it, and like I was just as amazed as anyone else to hear this statistic. And I think there is definitely this pattern, right? When you have a new wave of technology, it has this resetting function where like there is no such thing as someone with 10 years of experience writing Groth 16 code, right? Because 2024 minus 2016 is less than 10. But that just shows that it creates an opportunity, right? But then that opportunity still needs to be claimed. And there's this question of like what kinds of seeds can be planted to make sure that every time one of these opportunities appears, it actually does get claimed. Yeah, I mean, I think for us right now, this is still like an open and ongoing problem.
So I think it's important to be unequivocal about what our values are, but also to resist the attempts to control the epistemological sources of those values, because we can reach those values from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And one of the enemies is also a form of values nihilism, where we just decide that, you know, Western liberalism has been so trampled upon that there's no such thing anymore, and therefore it's a free-for-all, and it's the law of the jungle that the most powerful win. That's the risk that we fall in, is that we fall into that. And I think by developing this global liberalism, which implicitly accepts multiple perspectives, we can avoid that temptation.
So no dark enlightenment, but with more positivity. And the next one is, again, goes to Vitalik, is for me, there is one particular world liberalism moment in Ethereum, which is actually coincided with the moment I started to work in crypto. That was back in 2022, February, when Ukraine's official Twitter shared two cryptocurrency wallets, one for Ethereum, one for Bitcoin. And later on, as all of us know, Ethereum's community has contributed a huge amount of resource and capital to help the situation in Ukraine. So Vitalik, what is your most memorable Ethereum's world liberalism moment, and why?
I think, if I had to give an answer that's like very different from like that, like one instance of doing something really valuable for Ukraine and the world, I would actually just say this conference. And I think the reason why I say this is I think this particular one actually, even more than any of the previous ones I've seen, it really shows and makes obvious the fact that Ethereum as an ecosystem really is bringing people from all kinds of different parts of the world, from all kinds of different perspectives to come in to participate, to share their thoughts. One piece of feedback that I actually got is that other blockchain conferences often tends to look like Web2 trade shows, and it's organized top-down. DEF CON was not this, right? And there's just rooms where you can basically just go in and you can book it. And I'm sure sometimes people don't even book it, and you can just start a session. And a lot of the attractiveness of the conference was that. And I think to me the key thing, right, is the combination between that freedom of anyone to participate and to contribute together with the a positive sum mentality, right, and avoiding what was criticized at ECC as being like the side event zoo, right, where everyone would just make their own events, but then they'd end up like destructively competing with each other, and everyone was stuck in traffic even more, jumping between them for between 1 hour and the next. So I think events like this as in-person demonstrations of both the facts that all of these diverse communities within Ethereum exist, and also that there's all of these different sets of topics that people talk about, right? There's tracks, workshops, sub-events of all kinds of different themes, all kinds of different academic disciplines and intellectual emphases. It really proves for me personally that Ethereum continues to be the kind of ecosystem that actually has the ingredients to keep generating the solutions that people need going forward.
Appreciate that. This is quite a positive note. I have one last question, is for all the panelists. And before asking this question, and before opening the floor to the audience to ask questions, I want to make a very awkward attempt to give a little bit of hope. We know that the existence of non-liberal yet economic successful models worldwide are quite significant. Examples such as we previously mentioned Singapore as this liberal democracy, and China, a very successful economy with socialism with Chinese characteristics. Those two models are not only hostile to Western liberal democracy, but they're just indifferent in terms of accepting or getting, a lot of values we talk about. And we also see non-liberal and, in a sense, struggling models. We're in Thailand. Thailand is a country has a complex relationship with liberal democracy. This country's power is still concentrated in a monarchy and military. And then the Middle East, Argentina, Russia, which is currently in the war. Each of those cases present a myriad of conundrum, as liberalism doesn't necessarily make the sense. But disregard any of that, I think I want to go back to Vitalik's hopeful note is, I think what makes me feel hopeful is really the stage. Is about us, a bunch of nerdy people come here and listen and learn about liberalism as this archaic word. It is oddly hopeful to me. And sometimes when I see the contradiction of Ethereum itself, we're talking about meme coin, greedy meme coin traders, but we're also talking about in-depth, very idealistic cypherpunk people building stuff here. So I think the breadth of Ethereum's discussion and the breadth of those practices give me hope. So my question here is, hopefully everyone can leave this room with a little bit of hopeful note, is what makes you feel hopeful?
I think that we're very deeply scripted in the paradigm of centralization, the nation-state paradigm, in organizing in a command and control hierarchical way. It's the way, it's the system that we were raised in. It's the water that we swim in. And it tends to replicate because it's just your default. So when I see people really actively trying to come up with, you know, decentralized, non-hierarchical, voluntaristic methods of coordinating, like here at DevCon, that's what really gives me hope.
I think there's a sense in which the thing that we're fighting against is weaker than a lot of people think. And my own theory is that the dangerous ideology of this decade is actually not fascism per se, but nihilism. And I think you can see examples of this everywhere, right? Even you look at how the invasion of Ukraine gets justified, right? It's not Russia building a glorious thousand-year empire, right? Germany in the 1940s, well, you know, the narrative was that it's building a glorious thousand-year empire. Here it's not. The narrative is, yeah, we suck, but we're allowed to suck because other people suck too, right?
Yeah.
And we see nihilism, within crypto, and I think it's actually kind of encouraging to remember that, like, to see that it's not just a uniquely crypto problem. This is something that all of humanity is going through. And I think there definitely are things that are not just nihilism. Like, there definitely is the phenomenon that, like, there's portions of Silicon Valley who 10 years ago were libertarian because they thought they had no chance in hell of getting the government to listen to their concerns, but they're now much more centralization friendly because they can think they can become the next group of chief advisors. The nihilist part of it, it's ultimately self-defeating. Like, it's not it's something that eventually eats itself. It's not something that can really motivate and inspire people and bring people to, like, actually put their souls into a project at a very high standard of quality for many years. And I think the fact that, on the other hand, people who do care about a brighter future are working hard and are putting in the long-term work and are willing to increasingly find each other and support each other means that I think this group is likely to win.
I feel pretty optimistic about the future, mainly because 50 years ago, when you were born, you had kind of tattooed your area code in your life. I was born plus 54 in Argentina. And that gave centralized power, nation states, a lot of control over how you live, what music you listen to, what things you read, how you were able to work and not. And today, in this new digital world, we're much more humans that from this or that nation. And that embraces us in a global society in which liberalism values may be applied regardless of whatever nation states try to impose on you. And that makes me feel so good about the future.
Got curious about this idea of nihilism in Ethereum. I have to ask Vitalik what that is exactly. On the question of optimism, you know, for me, the main source of optimism is looking around and seeing that the systems of control that exist in the world, and I think you all see them, and perhaps some see some systems better than others, and that sometimes look so scary. Sometimes look so powerful and so scary. They do tend to be self-destructive. They do tend over the long term to undermine themselves, precisely because they are so incapable of seeing the world around them, incapable of understanding other views. In the end, they become weaker with time. It may well be a rule of history that the systems of oppression and control cannot be permanent. And if that's true, okay, then there's hope, right? Because the opposite of hope would be if these systems of oppression and control could become permanent. And I don't see that in history, and I don't see that in our own time, thankfully.
Two sentences are quite memorable. One is nihilism is self-defeating, and second is the thing we're fighting against is probably weaker than we think. Those are, I'm going to memorize those two lines for a long time. I'm going to wrap the talking part for now, and now we can enter the question answering stage for all the panelists. So shall we pull the questions up? And if you want to post new questions, you can scan the QR code.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so thank you very much for the questions. Lots and lots of questions have already been received, as you can see. So given that there's so many questions, of course, it's especially valuable if you vote, as you can get the questions that you really want answers up to the top. Yeah, and with that, I hand over to the Q&A.
Okay, I'm going to read the first one, which get the most votes. Is liberalism truly so universal? Aren't there collectivism cultures where explicitly deprioritize individual expression? As such, do ideas of pluralism subsume liberalism? That's a really good question. And I actually would ask, if you pose a question, maybe like tag someone, a panelist you wanna hear the answer from. And I guess for our four panelists, who wants to answer this question, you can jump in.
I think that this tension between a pluralistic ethos and individual rights is something that's happened in multiple cultures over time. It existed in European cultures, it's existed in African cultures, it's existed in the Far East, and it's a tension that communities tend to navigate. And it also tends to be an excuse used by authoritarians when they say, oh, individual rights doesn't work for us because we have a very pluralistic culture and we don't think about the individual. So I'd be cautious about believing people when they say that a specific culture does prioritize like the collective over the individual.
Okay, the next one is quite humorous and sharp. Speaking of Ethereum efforts to make Ethereum international community, is ETH Moscow possible?
It's a permissionless ecosystem.
We shall head to ETH Moscow if there's one. Next one. The losers of meritocracy in the USA are white and uneducated. They mainly voted for Trump, who promised even more meritocracy. How does this make sense? So, Diego or Bruno, want to take the answer?
Honestly, that would mean understanding people's psychological decisions on a global basis. I find it quite impossible. Honestly, I don't know how that makes sense.
I don't think people tend to assume Trump to be a phenomenon of extreme meritocracy. So just because he promises it, I wouldn't take that very seriously.
I agree.
I did go to a Trump rally a month ago, and it was quite interesting. One thing I discovered is that his supporters are really going through very difficult times economically. We have this idea of the United States as extraordinarily prosperous, but there are so many people left behind and struggling, and I think the other side has to realize that more.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask, to add my grain of sand on this, because Argentina has now President Milei, and we have a very similar situation. I mean, on one side you had maybe a candidate which proposed that the state was going to be more supportive of people, and on the other side you had a candidate which proposed basically an extremely libertarian agenda, and President Milei won. And I think that's mainly because struggling people in harsh economic conditions think, hey, this system as it is now is not working, we need to change it. Then let's embrace a change.
Next one is, humans seem to require religion as a source of identity. On the other hand, religion on the state level leads to a bad outcomes for human rights, Iran, for example. Do you have to get rid of religion?
a source of meaning as well as identity. I do agree that it leads to bad outcomes on a state level, and therefore we shouldn't have it on a state level. It should be a permissionless, like voluntaristic ecosystem. And states should have free expression and be credibly neutral.
Bruno, you talked about liberalism as a way to resist propaganda. Where is the delimiter between forced propaganda and free exchange of ideas?
Well, sometimes you only recognize it as propaganda if you make the effort of looking at things from different perspectives. In fact, in my own experience, without giving examples, it's sometimes the things that I thought were most obvious that upon further examination I discovered were really propaganda. But again, the effort here has to be the effort of stepping outside, looking at things from other cultures, living in different places, meeting many different people, and then the world opens up. But beforehand, before doing that, yeah, I guess it is not possible to distinguish the two.
Yeah. Well, network states lead to a global elite that attracts most resources, such as energy, water, lithium, clean air, and lets the poor suffer. I love this question, and I guess Vitalik wants to answer it.
Yeah, I mean, I think realistically there's good and bad outcomes from network states, but there's also good and bad outcome states for, I guess you might call, like the existing approach to like territory and to how people live, right? And the bad outcome there is basically like what we see with AI, where like the entire industry concentrates largely in San Francisco, and it's a very small group of people that are in a bubble that basically assume that AI is going to decide everything, and like they're in charge of AI and like basically implementing it according to a fairly narrow set of principles, but even just a narrow like individual interests, right? And with network states, of course, the risk is that basically this turns into another way for like small elites to essentially wall themselves off and become like Elysium and support each other and protect each other and then not actually have any incentive alignment with the outside world anymore. But I think it's also important to remember that the nation state order to a large extent is exactly that as well. And the positive side of this is if something like network states actually does lead to creating new connections between people who have resources and have power who come from those existing centers, but then actually making positive connections with people in a much broader set of regions and people who have a much broader set of needs. And I think there have been proto-examples of that starting to happen. And so I think ultimately like which side it turns into is going to depend heavily on the kinds of people that actually run these things and what decisions they make and what they prioritize.
Okay, the next one is, I also love this question. Is the good times make weak people, weak people make hard times make strong people just a funny trope or real? If real, where are we? Are we in a hard time or good time?
If it's just a meme, I'd say it's a very old meme, because the oldest articulation of it that I'm aware of was Ibn Khaldun, who was an Arabic philosopher who's considered the founder of modern sociology. And he wrote this several hundred years ago. He basically observed that human societies tend to last something like 3 or 4 generations and are often taken over by new communities who come out of who basically come from the margins. So yeah, maybe there's something there.
In ancient Greece, I forget if this was Thucydides or Herodotus or someone else, there was the progression choros, hubris, ate, nemesis, right? That prosperity leads to hubris and then that leads to destruction. So I think there's definitely been similar themes that people have observed for a long time.
How to make Ethereum community not explicitly pro-Western, despite the fact that most venture money come from the US? Another really good question.
Are we possibly that most venture money comes from the US. There are tons of money coming from Asia as well. I don't have that metric, honestly.
Do you want to answer the question, Vitalik?
I want to hear other people's answers. What's your answer? You haven't answered a question yet.
I shall volunteer my labor to read the questions. My answer is, I think a lot of the venture money come from the U.S. And Asia, of course, are coming from a subset of hyper elite people, and I think they are the problem. This is my answer. Okay. Did anybody know that the first attempt at getting rid of a fiat currency was made by the USSR in 1929? Why does nobody see the many intersections between crypto philosophy and Marxism?
I mean, lots of people do, right? There is an entire account called the Blockchain Socialist.
Yes, I was also saying that, hosted by Josh. He's a great guy. Okay, I think we have 30 seconds for the last question. Unpopular take, does liberalism lead to better outcome, or is collectivism better? Or is collectivism better? Looking at climate change, crime rates, etc.
You know, but I think in the end it has to be about human freedom. So freedom can be experienced collectively, you can organize collectively. That's a misperception that liberalism has to be against all that. I don't know many people who would say, you know, the important thing is the really valuable thing is the state or the nation. In the end, even the state and the nation have to be for the sake of individual experience.
And I do think it's a false dichotomy because it's not liberalism versus collectivism. It's maintaining individual freedoms whilst having institutions that enable you to coordinate effectively for the greater good, solving the problems of the commons.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess the god of DEF CON give us 5 minutes more, or what's the... it says hand over time, so I...
Thank you for listening. Be sure to visit archive.devcon.org to watch and listen to all the other DEF CON talks. We look forward to seeing you next time.